Right. So hello and welcome everyone to whoever is listening to this particular podcast. For this podcast, I have with us Dr. Sebastian Rushka. He's the lead AI educator at Grid AI, and he's also the author of the book Machine Learning with PyTorch and Scikit-Learn, and also a few other books that cover the fundamentals of machine learning and deep learning techniques and implementing them with Python. He was also an assistant professor of statistics at University of Wisconsin-Madison and has been actively involved in making machine learning more accessible for beginners through his blogs, video tutorials, tweets, and of course, his books. He also holds a doctorate in computational and quantitative biology from Michigan State University. So, Sebastian, welcome to this podcast, and it's so nice to finally talk to you.
Yeah, thanks so much for the kind invitation to be on your podcast, Jay. I'm really excited. Just two things top of my head. Thanks so much for the kind introduction. But the only person really who calls me Dr. Sebastian is actually my parents when they write me postcards. And I think that's a joke when they address a postcard. So yeah, we can just go by Sebastian. I almost forget that, this is a thing, like the PhD is so long ago, I barely remember. So we can just go by Sebastian. I'm actually technically still an assistant professor. I'm just, exploring, let's say, the startup culture right now, but I'm still technically at the university. So that just wanted to mention that I haven't left the university yet. But yeah, I'm really excited. We can maybe talk about this even, like, about my new role as lead AI educator at Grid AI. But yeah, I will let you ask the questions before I just, you know, spontaneously chat about things.
Yeah, definitely. It's good for the minor correction. And I'll keep the Sebastian name for the reference for this podcast.
By the way, if you want to keep it even shorter, you can just go by Seb. So that was Seb. One thing. Multiple people came up with that independently, like S-E-B, Seb. Because I was like, my name is like eight letters, right? Or might be nine, eight. And it's pretty long. And people, I think, don't want to say Sebastian all the time. So somehow it just happened that people recently called me Seb, and I was like, why not, actually? So yeah, short and snappy.
Yeah, definitely that works too. Yeah. But learning more about you, as in, so you have a unique roadmap of experience going from working with AI techniques, going from applying a machine learning to computational biology to now being an educator, where you are educating and making ML more accessible for students. So what was your personal entry point into AI? Like, what made you interested about it and pursue this as a major part of your career?
Oh yeah, that is a long time ago. When I was a student, I was really into computational biology, like solving problems around, let's say, drug discovery. So drug discovery is like loosely like a field where you are looking for potential small molecules that can have an effect. Let's say if there's a disease, they can have an effect on, let's say, preventing the disease. And for that, it is like a search for the needle in the haystack. And you are basically also interested in predicting things before you test things experimentally, because it's very expensive to run experiments in a in a biology context, because you have all the setup and all the, let's say, researchers that have to pipette things and stuff like that. So my professor back then, that was like when I was just new in grad school, recommended me to take this class in, it was called Introduction to Statistical Pattern Recognition. Mm-hmm. Or classification, one of the two. And it was a class about Bayesian methods for predictions. And I found this super interesting, because at that point, I was just coding things and coming up with rules myself. It's actually almost like how people got motivated, like developing machine learning, like having the computer learn from the data. And yeah, back then, I was just taking this class, and I found it so fascinating that I just started studying it. So we had this textbook by Duda and Stark. I think it was just called Pattern Classification. And then there was also like a faculty in the computer science department who was teaching data mining, and I took this class as a follow-up. But yeah, this was basically the time where I really got into blogging, sharing what I learned, like when I wrote these blog posts about principal component analysis, RBF kernel SVMs, and these types of things. And yeah, that got me really interested. And most of it is then really studying books. And I also took back then Andrew Eng's online class, the first Coursera class ever. I think it was like 2011. And I got really interested in that. So yeah, that's in a nutshell my journey.
Yeah. It's always good to know about how many people have been inspired from courses by the Andrew Ng. Like most of the people I know who got interested in a very simplistic sense into machine learning and AI happen to have that course being taken up every now and then. So it's always good to know. But one interesting thing that also, like you mentioned, is like you started off by reading books to versus now you're writing books that can help. And I think I got a chance to like look at the latest book, which involves the scikit-learn and PyTorch. And I think like we already talked offline about this, is like I really like the syllabus that you have plotted out in these books. But before we go into the content of this book, I wanted to learn, like when you were a student, like you said, these books that help you understand the statistics, the implementation and the theory behind these techniques. What was the point that helped you? What was the set of resources that helped you regarding the implementation? I assume back a few years, like there would be even lesser online resources that can help you with the basics of implementing, debugging these, and like revolving and hitting your head when the implementations don't work. So what was your best practice for that?
Yeah, that is a good question, because really, like you suggested, still, I think today there are not that many, let's say, books or resources that really teach you how to implement things. It's mostly, so if you look for books on implementations, it's usually they are showing you how to use a library, or let's say scikit-learn, TensorFlow, PyTorch, and so forth. And I think this is important, and it's great because that's how you would use things in practice. You don't want to, let's say, write something from scratch, because, well, you might make mistakes. And if it's an important application, let's say drug discovery, it might lead to bad consequences if you have mistakes or some things don't work. And also it takes a lot of time. And then also efficiency-wise, your implementation is maybe taking 3 days to run, where an existing one takes a few minutes. However, I think it is a very important and useful exercise to implement things from scratch. And it's like a weird thing how I learned this. It's by a reverse engineering almost. So because in the class that I mentioned, the Introduction to Statistical Pattern Classification class, we had homework in, I think it was MATLAB. Yeah, Andrew Ng's class was Octave, which is an open source version of MATLAB. And for the homework, we got like partial, let's say, implementations of algorithms. But I hated MATLAB. So I was really trying. So also it was easier for me, to be honest, just to be coding in Python, because I was already familiar with Python. So I was taking this MATLAB thing and was just kind of like reverse engineering it in Python so that I can then run the code and then also come up with a solution for the homework, make sure everything works, because I'm more confident in my Python code. And then I was taking the solution or the approach in Python and was then reverse engineering it and implementing it in MATLAB to submit the homework. Yeah, in that case, I kind of learned by looking at other people's code, in a sense. But many things I also implemented from scratch, just like I call them first principles, but it's really like, so also currently I'm working on a class where I take this approach, where I implement things as simple as possible. So I try to understand the algorithm. Like, for example, imagine a dot product. So you can actually implement a dot product with just a Python for loop. So you have a for loop, and then let's say you have a weight and X and W, and you just multiply them and sum them up with a for loop, rather than, let's say, using dot product in NumPy. And I try to, when I implement things the first time, to be as simple as possible. I mean, nowadays, okay, a dot product is maybe simpler for me because it's just like one command. But if there's a new concept, I usually try to not use anything fancy. That is like, mostly I find linear algebra is very helpful to write down things more compactly. But sometimes you can have like these silent issues where you feel like you're doing the right thing, but so it should throw an error, but just happens that the dimensions match the columns and rows, and then it works, but the results are totally off or something. So I try to usually do things, let's say, as simple as possible, get the code to run, and then I write unit tests or just look at the output and have some examples, and then I refine my code, make it, let's say, more sophisticated, while trying to really get the same results. So it's like a step where you make it as simple as possible so you can better read your code, get the right results, or let's say you think they are the right results, and then you refine your code. And I think this process really helps with learning. It's the same thing when I look at other people's code, I usually take the code and run it like one bit at a time, like adding breakpoints in a debugger and really trying to understand step by step what's happening. Because code is really complex. And for me personally, it really helped also looking at or collaborating on projects. So I had this library MLExtend where I implemented certain things. Some people contributed. I looked make things compatible with scikit-learn. And in this process, when I was coding like these compatible things, I learned a little bit more about how scikit-learn works. I learned how to read the code. And nowadays I would say a lot of it is C++ code, which is pretty complicated. But still, if you spend you have to spend the time with it. But if you spend the time, you can easily learn that. I mean, not easily, but it's really like taking one thing at a time, one step at a time. And you can approach a problem. I mean, it's maybe sometimes frustrating if you only have so much time and then you look at this and it's like 200 lines of code, but I need to have the results tomorrow or something like that. But so it is tricky, but I would say try to solve one thing at a time and start simple and yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I really love the idea, as in like you have learned much more on a hands-on basis. So like you start by implementing from scratch, then you see what doesn't work, then you go back, trace back, and then keep on one by one step and until the end point that you reach. But one also think that, which I completely agree to the idea, like I work on a lot of image processing tools, and the standard, if you see back a few years, was MATLAB. Like it was the case, but recently we have seen most of the deep learning models are having a lot of libraries or functionalities built inherently, mm-hmm. which handle image processing even better than what MATLAB used to. Like MATLAB was priding for the kind of architecture it has for image preprocessing. So why do you personally think like Python is kind of becoming the standard that people are getting started with it and also developing high end? It's not just like for people who are beginning into this thing, but also building like scalable applications that are much more relying on Python. Is it the ease of use that's inherent to Python, or is it also the architecture behind Python? Like, this is just like a curious question.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know the exact answer, but it is somewhat related, I would say, to what you said, the ease of use. Like, what I like about, I can just say maybe what I like about Python, and maybe that's also why other people are, let's say there's this kind of momentum behind it, and or the certain there's maybe like this turning point where it got somewhat popular, and then it was like a snowball effect or something like that. So one thing like you mentioned is like it looks easy, or it is very readable. I think the fact that we have this indentation in Python like makes code very readable. And I'm not sure if you have seen like it's mostly older papers like pseudocode where people write an algorithm in like some, let's say, arbitrary language. And I feel like Python is almost like that. It is. If you show some algorithm like as a pseudocode in Python, or you can write it in Python, I think a lot of people who are not familiar with Python would be able to read it, because it is the way it's indented and like if else and how everything is formatted, no parentheses usually and stuff. It makes things kind of readable, and this gets you, I think, started with finding it pleasant to use. But then at the other hand, what I find is also really the community behind Python is really what's maybe driving its success, because there are so many great tools in Python that make your life easier. And all the resources, I mean, all the cool conferences, SciPy, it's like this thing where you feel like, okay, a lot of people are using that. And if I use that, I have a lot of people, let's say, if I have questions, I can ask them, I can look for tutorials, and there are so many libraries that I can use. And I think all of that together makes it really pleasant to use. I mean, it's of course not the most efficient language. It's probably one of the worst languages when it comes to efficiency, but it's also not a big deal, because it is usually more like a gluing language where you glue together more efficient implementations. There was this article the other day, forgot the exact name. I tweeted about this like a couple of days ago. It was like the unreasonable rise of Python in scientific computing, something like that. And so the person who wrote this article argued that Yeah, sure. Python is relatively slow by itself, but it makes you, first of all, there's also the productivity of the developer. So the time that it takes you to write the code and time it takes you to execute the code, it's not always about just that the code runs faster. So let's say you have to run an analysis only one time, and it takes you 3 days to write the code. Maybe it runs in 10 seconds, but still you have to spend 3 days to write the code. In Python, maybe you can do this, write the code in 2 days. Maybe it takes half an hour to run. But in total, you are faster towards getting the results. If you then maybe deploy the algorithm on a server, let's say Google, where it has to run like 1 billion queries every day, then maybe you should think about re-engineering that. But I think most daily tasks for machine learning and data scientists are really also where you run things maybe once or twice, but really it takes most of the time to just write the code itself. And then there was this interesting part about this article, which I found cool, like an anecdote where the author mentioned an example where someone wanted to implement a nearest neighbor search. And yeah, sure. If you use Fortran or C++, the nearest neighbor search will be faster because the code is faster. And you can maybe even write it very easily because it's just like the brute force version is just like you iterate through each data point and then compute the distance and then sort the distances and pick the closest data point. So I think this should be not too complicated in any language, but then still, this is a very naive solution if you would check every neighbor and stuff. So there are special data structures like ball trees or KD trees, and they are implemented in SciPy. And I think if you use something like Python, you are more likely to stumble upon them because you have all the documentation and tutorials than if you would be using C++ or Fortran. Of course, you can also, of course, implement a KD tree in Fortran, which is like a data structure that makes the lookup more efficient. But I think you're more likely, so that was the point of the article, and I also believe so, that you're more likely to find this if you're in an ecosystem like Python where there's more resources around, and it kind of encourages this kind of reuse of existing libraries. So yeah, so the naive search would be faster in Fortran, but if you use Python with this KD tree, you're even faster than that, right? So it's like this, that's what I think is cool about Python, because you have so many libraries and this huge ecosystem around it.
Yeah. No, I completely second that. And this is something that even recently happened at my lab is like when Python is really good when you want to, like at least in research, when you want to just quickly check your proof of concept, like you just want to say, okay, if this works or not. And in that case, I don't want that overhead of implementing in C++, which will take me at least a few days to just to see that, okay, this results actually don't work. So it's like very quick the other end. And we also joked about it, like if scikit-learn and numpy was monetized, like if they were monetizing the use of library, like this would be a big business because like everybody on the other end on research is using these tools, and we are just glad these are like open source. So
So also one thing about this is like you mentioned, it's a great way for prototyping things too, like getting the first draft out, but then also there are really cool tools that can take your prototypes and make them really fast, like Cython just had its 20th birthday like a few days ago. So Cython is like a library where you compile your Python code to, or you can mix and match Python and C++ code. And I think most of scikit-learn uses Cython, which is also then the best of both worlds. You have your prototype, and then you don't even have to completely rewrite something in a different language. You use something like Cython, which is great. So I think there are lots of hacks in Python where people kind of like make Python work, even though it's not the fastest. There are like these tricks to make it fast. And in, for example, PyTorch, which is a deep learning library for like it's the deep learning library these days. Yeah. And the main API is also through Python. And some people worry about, okay, if I use Python and then this dynamic graph, it might be very slow compared to, let's say, using CUDA directly. Yeah, it is maybe a little bit slower, but PyTorch also has this C++ API. And usually, on average, the overhead of just using Python is just 10%. So if you think about it, if you train a model for, let's say, 10 hours, it's a difference of 1 hour whether you use Python or C++. It is maybe, I don't know, if you're a big company, you run this model every day 1 million times, that makes maybe a difference. But for a researcher, if you wait 10% more, you're always so busy, you don't really mind waiting 10% more because you save the time by writing the code, right? So in that case, you make up for it for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And for researchers, like the results are more interesting than actually the implementation. So they want to dwell more on the results and analysis rather than that.
One more thing, if you don't mind. This is actually how I also got into Python. Is I was actually, I started using R most of the time. So my R and the command line for stuff, there was like gnuplot for plotting. And I used R for statistics. And then I sometime learned using ggplot for plotting. And but then also with R, I felt like I was not super productive in terms of data wrangling. So I had this computational biology stuff where I had like these weird data sets and I wanted to extract data and at least get the data into the right form. So I wrote these scripts in Python because with Python I could quickly do that. And then I was visualizing things in R. And I always had to go like back and forth between two languages. And then sometimes I was writing intermediate files and stuff. And then, like you said, most of the time you spend really, or you care about the results and also getting the results easily. I mean, if you have a plot, it doesn't really matter which language you use because it's like the execution time is very fast. What you care about is how to format the data right and filter it. And I was, your mileage may vary, and I have a lot of colleagues who like R, but I, for some reason, found Python way easier for that. So, also to get me to the results, that is why I was adopting Python, because I could just format the data more easily and grab the data from the files and these types of things. So it's a very, also, one thing about it is it's very versatile. I mean, some people use Python for building web applications like Django, and I don't know what the web application or frameworks are called nowadays, but back then it was Flask and Django. And then you have plotting or data science, you have machine learning, you have basically everything you can do in Python. It's very, very versatile, which is really great.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And again, like going back to the original question where we branched off is like, basically you have written this very fantastic books, like, and the latest one talks more about PyTorch and scikit-learn. But I believe there are earlier versions that actually also talk about the basics of Python fundamentals and machine learning. So can you talk more about like who this book is really for and like people who want to get a quick teaser into this? It's like, what does this book cover? Like what does this set of books cover from start till the end, and who this book is really for? So if they're interested, who should get into it?
So the book Machine Learning with PyTorch and Scikit-learn is almost like two books, like the title suggests. So it's like Machine Learning with Scikit-learn, and then also the first part is Scikit-learn, and the second part is really PyTorch. But I think, why I like also grouping it into one book was that it gives the readers a journey, because nowadays we have machine learning, the traditional machine learning without neural networks, and we have deep learning, which is based on deep neural networks. And one common question, I teach two classes at the university. One is Introduction to Machine Learning and Pattern Classification, and one is Introduction to Deep Learning and Generative Modeling. And so one class is machine learning, and class is deep learning, and sometimes students ask me, well, which class should I take? And I would say ideally both, not because I want to advertise my classes, but also because I think it really depends on what type of problem you want to solve, and there are different, let's say, emphases. So with regular machine learning, with the first part of the book, so first of all, who it's for, it's, I would say, anyone who's interested in machine learning and deep learning. And the only requirement I would say is Python programming, having some knowledge in Python, ideally also NumPy. It's not like, I would say, a strong requirement, but being a little bit familiar with that, I think that would be good. But otherwise, it's really for everyone who's interested in using machine learning and deep learning and really getting started. And so with machine learning, this part, also similar to my course, what I cover is really what is a classification algorithm, and how do we evaluate our models? How do we do hyperparameter tuning? How do we improve the performance? How do we measure that this is really a meaningful improvement? How do we get the data into the right shape? Like, how do I have to format my data? How do I, if I have, let's say, categorical variables, how do I encode them correctly? Like, really getting set up for the machine learning, I would say, mindset, like how to use machine learning. And then also the non-deep learning machine learning, what it is really good at, or what it was originally developed for, is these tabular data sets, almost like basically spreadsheet data. And Then for deep learning, I mean, why deep learning is really like useful and powerful and impressive is it's more like for this unstructured data. So with unstructured data, I mean more like image data or text, something that is not in this table form. And if you think about it like this, back in the day, it was very difficult to, let's say, process large data sets and everything. And also regular machine learning algorithms, they suffer from something called like the curse of dimensionality. So if you have an image, even something like MNIST, which is like 28 by 28, that's 784 pixels, it's 784 dimensions, if you will. And machine learning algorithms, they would, traditional ones would overfit. It would mean basically what they would be trying to do is memorize exact pixel locations. So if you are trying to classify, let's say, a number like the number 7, it would try to memorize exact pixel locations. And that is not good because, well, if you move the number a little bit over to the left or to the right, it's still the same number, but the machine learning algorithm, because it tried to memorize the exact position, might fail. Deep learning. So how to prevent that would be, for example, extracting features manually. So like taking some measurements and maybe writing some other features down. There's this famous iris data set. So iris data or iris are like certain flowers, and the task is to predict what species of the flower it is. And how you could do this nowadays is like you could take pictures of these flowers and then train a deep learning algorithm. Back then, how people solved this problem was like taking measurements. So someone took a ruler and measured how wide and how tall the leaves are and writing this down in a table. So if you do this, if you take a measurement of the length of a leaf, it's one feature. Then you take the width of the leaf, it's two features. And there are two different types of leaves. One is called sepal and petal. So you end up with four features instead of, if you have, let's say, 1,000 by 1,000 pixel image with a high resolution camera, you have 1 million features. So you reduce the 1 million features to four features. I mean, this is then good input for machine learning. The only thing is you have to know what you are measuring, right? Because is maybe the flower dimension, the leaf dimension even useful for classification? So for that, you need like these types of domain experts who come up with let's say the idea what we want to measure, what is maybe useful for the machine learning classifier. But yeah, we have many types of data where we have something like that. And this is like a good, I would say, case for machine learning. And then if you are a little bit more ambitious, if you, let's say, want to remove this intermediate step of feature extraction, deep learning basically solves the problem like learning from image or text data directly. And so in this book, we start with these simple data sets that are these tables, and then we go to deep learning later where we really, if we have image data and text data. But also of course, I mean, to be really honest, if you work in a company or even like for your hobby projects, you don't always have images. It really depends on what problem you want to solve. If you want to develop a spam classifier, you have text data, right? So you need a different algorithm or different approach for that. And in this book, we cover a variety of different methods for different types of data sets. So one is, for example, also graph data. So like coming back to the computational biology background context where we have molecules, and molecules are basically, you can think of them as atoms connected by covalent bonds, which are then, you can think of it as a graph. And so there are different types of data, and different types of data require different types of algorithms. But in a nutshell, this book is really for everyone interested in machine learning and deep learning, and it's split, I would say, roughly into two parts, getting familiar with machine learning and then going to deep learning if you have, let's say, image or text data. Actually, there's one data set that we move, that I use throughout the book, at least three times. It's it's a classic data set, but it's simple and it's, I would say, moderately interesting. It's the IMDb movie review data set, which is a collection of 50,000 movie reviews. And there, I mean, it's a relatively, I would say, large data set. If you think about 50,000, sound like a lot, but for deep learning, it's not that much. So one difference is also, or one thing to mention is, deep learning really requires a lot of data. It's attractive because you can solve problems without having domain knowledge. You can just, let's say, feed it images. I mean, domain knowledge doesn't hurt, but you don't have to, let's say, manually extract features from the images. But then you also need much more data. And so with this movie data set, we use it three times. One is in the sentiment analysis chapter, in chapter, I think, 8, where we use a traditional machine learning algorithm. There is a way you can transform this data into a tabular form with a back-of-words model. And I forgot the numbers, but it might be something, let's say, 89% accuracy or something. So you build a classifier with traditional machine learning with 89% accuracy. And then we go to deep learning and we implement something called a recurrent neural network. And I think the accuracy is even lower because, well, deep learning is more powerful, but at the same time, it requires more data. And 50,000 is maybe not quite enough for deep learning. So it's also something to consider when you are thinking about which method to use. It's always good to, let's say, I would say, start with simple baselines, like using a method that is not super complicated, see what results you get before you, let's say, go to the more expensive method like deep learning, because sometimes the simpler method already solves the problem. And also, you know, okay, maybe this is simpler and even more efficient than me like training these expensive neural networks. But then, yeah, we use it a third time in the transformer section where we fine-tune one of these BERT models, the BERT, the big transformer models. And there we get actually better performance than with the simple method. I think the performance is, let's say, 92 or 93% accuracy. But then, see, the caveat is this takes like, 3 hours to train on a GPU or something like that, compared to the simple classifier in scikit-learn, which takes a few minutes. So it's always a trade-off. So yeah. But that was like a very long answer to a very short question. Sorry.
No, but I mean, it makes sense. I mean, you covered from a lot of techniques, like starting from very basics to, I think we covered like graph database. We also covered transformers. We also covered deep learning techniques. So, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned about graph because that was one of the chapters I quickly jumped to because I'm recently working with a new type of data set, which is like a RNA based sequencing. Mm. And we are trying to see if the RNA structure would basically conform to its true value. And that's where I'm trying to learn about graph convolution neural networks and also understanding how people are using graph data sets into deep learning. So that was something I jumped to into that book because I wanted to start from the basic. I understand how the how we used to treat like graph data sets in our past, you know, like the classic data structures algorithms, like where we are using graph data sets for traveling salesman problem and Dijkstra's algorithm and all those things. But yeah, that is something I'm coming back.
RNA in terms of the ribonucleic acid RNA?
Yes.
Yeah, I learned about this a long time ago. So that's also basically where you have nucleotides, right? And each nucleotide would be then one point in your graph, or
yes. So they are. I think. I mean, I'm bad at the whole terminology for these. I understand all these things only from a dataset perspective, but I think there are like around four nucleotides which basically connect to each other, and they are interested. Like humans have these long chains of RNA structures, and you basically have to make sure if this structure is stable or not. And there are, I think, like millions of combinations that could be possible. And there are some already techniques who can judge those structure stability, what they call scores. It's basically if you arrange all these, like there are A, G, T, U, C, and all those numbers, but we treat them as numbers. I don't know the medical significance or biological significance of this. But you basically give this score to a structure, and the highest the score, meaning it has the highest probability of actually occurring in real life. So they are using deep learning techniques to actually see how it will unfold and fold these RNA structures.
It's a sequence, but it can also fold into a three-dimensional structure, right? Like the tertiary structure. Yeah. Long time ago, like 10, 20, 15 years ago. But it's interesting. Yeah,
definitely. But yeah, that was more like a question from a student's perspective, like what is this book about and what I'm learning. But I wanted to, I'm curious about a question from an author's perspective because I'm a person who is like actively now involved as a writing my work as in like publishing stuff where we try to map what we did to like a paper and condensing it into very succinct form. So I'm curious, like what goes into writing a good technical book? Because this is something very, very, I think I would be very challenged if I were to write a book because talking about implementation takes a hell lot of, I would say, effort to actually make sure that making sure the audience understands in a very broad range of spectrum. And when I'm even also helping my lab mate debug a problem, it's like a very, very bad answer that I can give, even he or she would have a very, very hard time to understand. So I want to learn, like, what was your thought process, first of all, deciding to write a book? And secondly, what exactly goes into writing a technical book? Like, technical book is something very rare. Like, you don't find a lot of books who write technical implementation stuff. So I wanted to know your thought process.
That's a good question. What made me write this book? Actually, the simple answer is, the publisher reached out at some point and I said yes. That was the short answer. But I was thinking about this. Should I do this or not? And as a student, you are busy, right? So it's like, should you do it or not? But then at some point I was like, okay, I like writing and maybe it's a fun challenge. Let me try. I would say as a student, I was busy. Now I'm even busier. So I'm kind of like glad that I did this then, like the first book, because that was then a template for my later book. So I basically extended this. I think it helps me. What I like about writing is it helps me also getting things out of my head onto paper. It's like, you know, when you take notes, it's like you think about something and you try keep thinking about it, how things work. And sometimes it's just helpful to write it down somehow, because then you don't have to constantly think about it. And you know, okay, it's in a safe place. If I ever need this again, I know where to find it. And a book, for me, it was more like the book was the more polished version of that. So where I was like, okay, these are my interesting concepts, things I feel like are really interesting and exciting. And I've done them at some point. I have maybe rough notes, but let's say I need them in the future again or something like that. So if you write that down in a book once nicely, you have that for life, basically. So sometimes, I mean, nowadays, let's say I don't use something very frequently, like the graph neural network. I don't want to write this from scratch every time. I know, okay, I've done that one time. Well, I can then go there and copy and paste it and then make adjustments. So it's basically almost like my personal knowledge base. And at the same time, it's fun. It's like you get to share it, you write the book and some people find it useful. And I really like, let's say, getting feedback. And sometimes also people ask you really tricky questions about things you have never thought about. And this is also a way to learn. So I feel like writing a book is like almost like a more advanced, like you learn something and then you think about it and you write it down. And sometimes you get feedback. And this writing down and getting feedback is really like, it goes beyond the regular learning, because you're not just absorbing the language, the knowledge. You are kind of like actively processing it and then even extending it. And I like that. I like learning. It's like every day I try to spend at least 1 hour reading another book, or let's say watching some talks. So I try to always learn new things, and writing down is also part of my learning process in a way. There's this also challenge, I don't know why, but I really like this, is like thinking about the structure of books and articles and these types of things. I don't know, it's maybe my I have like this thing where I like organize things, people make fun of it, but my computer is super organized, all the folders and everything has like a certain process. And the same is true for me for like knowledge organization, like how you put things together. And and writing a book is also like, the challenge is like, in which order do you cover things? And there are pros and cons, and you have to weigh them kind of carefully, especially with a big field like machine learning. Everything is connected, and you always, you can't be perfect. You can only try to, let's say, minimize, you want to minimize concepts or the introduction of concepts if you don't explain them right away. But then at the same time, you don't want to explain everything at a given moment, because then you get bogged down into detail. So it's like this fun little challenge, in which order you introduce concepts. I like that a lot for some reason. It's like a fun exercise.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that makes sense why you are better at this, because you are much more structured into delivering knowledge, which makes sense. I mean, that completely suits your line of career. So, kudos to you for doing that, because even I think when I'm referring to a lot of online resources, which I think are still like not the best, but I think they are the only good resources, you see them and you can obviously see those limitations. But I mean, now being, if I were to write a blog, I would have the same challenges, because it's just too many thoughts going on. How do I make sure I start from A, B, C, and then go to the Z part, versus like having a whole zigzag part to it. So kudos for that, for doing that.
Yeah, so I maybe like one little tip, but maybe it doesn't work for everyone, but when I write things, how I do it is I first make a mind map. So it's basically like almost like an outline. There's different software for that, but what I really like is just putting your thoughts on there, like all the things that just come to mind. You have a topic and you just write it all down. Could be totally unorganized, and then you try to order them and you try to make a hierarchy, and in that way you are thinking before, like you're writing. So you basically make the outline, all the topics that are related. And once you have that, once you have like the structure, I feel like the writing becomes much easier. I think the hardest part is really if you just have a blank page and you start writing, because I think then it becomes a mess. And because then you write something and you maybe realize, okay, that was maybe not ideal, but at this point it's very expensive to move it to a different section because it's a flow and you have to kind of pick it apart again. So I feel like also it's kind of like daunting to have like a white page and then just starting writing. For me personally, how I like to organize things, but it is again just me, maybe it works differently for others, it's really like putting things down in a mind map and then rearranging things to make sense of the order. And then I usually export this into Markdown and have these headlines and sometimes even paragraphs, and then just fill in the blanks. It's really like going from structure first to like filling in the blanks, which really helps me with not being afraid of the writing. It's like, okay, I know what has to go where. I just have to spend some time filling in these blanks basically.
I love that. I love that. Like I could only wish I could do that as efficiently as you're saying, but yeah, I mean, I love the idea. Going into the idea, like once, let's say we have learned these skills from most of the tutorials you see, lectures that we get to learn from professors are working on toy datasets, like Iris and even MNIST. We feel they are toy datasets, and we when we go on to research or even in the industry when we are working on some real datasets, I see, at least I personally noticed, like there are a hell lot of challenges that we haven't known, but we normally figure out on the way. So what kind of things you would say for people who are on the journey to learning from these books or at least tutorials, but something when we go into the real world, when we work on some actual data sets, like raw data sets collected from scanners in case of healthcare or even from other equipments, what are the things that people should expect that based on you would have insights on when we apply these machine learning techniques? It's often the case, like data pre-processing and data pipeline is like a very crucial role that I have personally learned. Like what would you say, what insights would you have when people are trying to deal with these machine learning tools when they work on real data sets versus toy data sets?
Yeah, so I would say based on my collaborations with people in other, let's say, departments, like, let's say, social sciences and biology, the biggest challenge is how to get, so basically, what are you trying to solve, right? It would be one, so like putting like down the expectation, like what do you want to do? When is it good enough? How do we evaluate the success? And then like, when it comes really to the implementation, really, what type of data do I need and in what form? So a lot of problems, there is data, but the data is maybe not in the right form for machine learning. It's like, it's this, it's a big challenge. It's like, let's say there was like a project we worked on. It was on predicting whether a video contains conspiracy content or not. And then really, what type of data do you need? Like, okay, we have videos, but how do you get the videos into a right format? We could also use deep learning for that, of course, based on frames, but it's then the challenge you have to think about. Okay, how do you present the data? First, you have to download it, you have to maybe format it, you have to label it. And so in this case, like getting the data, so what is your data? How does it look like? How do you get that into a right shape for your method? What methods do you want to consider? What is like your expectation in terms of performance? And yeah, these types of things. There are lots of challenges. So another project we worked on was on, say all the details because I don't know how, let's say, sensitive this is. So let's say in an abstracted form, we were interested in classifying emails, and we had 50,000 emails, and we wanted to, there was a certain type of classification task. And the problem then is really, okay, we have 50,000 emails, no labels. How do you approach that? Right. And I mean, you can use traditional machine learning, you can use deep learning, and there are within deep learning many different methods. There are many other considerations like data cleaning. So how do you even start? So writing down a process is maybe a good idea. So maybe just implementing a simple baseline. There are, for example, dictionary-based approaches. You can say like if and else statements, if these words are there, then it's, let's say, this type of email. Like if you categorize it by a topic like climate, technology, politics, and stuff like that, you can maybe use a dictionary-based approach as your baseline. And you can do regular machine learning. You can use logistic regression or naive Bayes classifier and a back of words model, then you can use RNNs, you can use transformers. And for each of them, you also need a different level of data, right? So for the dictionary-based approach, it's not a training method, really. It's just based on dictionary. You don't have to train a model. So for that, yeah, small number of data points is enough. I mean, you don't even need any data points. You just need a test set to make sure how good is this. But then for the machine learning, you maybe need 50 or 100 emails at least. How do you get these? So who's labeling them? You can maybe label them yourself. You can ask your colleagues. But then also you have to make sure things are consistent, right? So, and then for deep learning, you maybe need hundreds of thousands of labeled emails. Is this even feasible? Can you maybe use a related data set and pre-train your model? And so I would say always starting with the simplest thing. So starting with a dictionary-based approach, right? So maybe it gives you in a balanced data set 80% accuracy. Then you use machine learning, you notice, okay, I only get 70% accuracy with my naive Bayes classifier. Maybe the model is not good enough, but maybe I don't have enough data. Maybe I only have 100 data points labeled, and maybe that's not enough. So you could come up with, let's say, a hypothesis and say, okay, maybe more data is helpful, rather than like switching to a different methods, rather than spending time tuning hyperparameters, maybe I should just collect more data. And I think in practice, that is one thing I noticed in collaborations is for people who, let's say, don't work so much with deep learning or machine learning, is let's say they encounter on the news or in general articles that are very impressive. So they think it's reasonable to get really good performance. But in practice, it may be true, but only mostly on benchmark data sets. And then if things don't work, it's easy, like what I noticed is a pattern, it's easy to say, then let's try a different method. Let's tune this more. Let's run grid search like for 3 days or something. But sometimes it's just, in this email example, more productive to just maybe label a few more data points. So instead of instead of logistic regression, naive Bayes or support vector machines, maybe we should just sit down for an hour and label 30 more emails and see if that improves the performance. So like managing the expectations is one of the challenges, I think. And also really organizing what you want to do in which order, because there are infinitely many things you can try.
Yeah. And I want to extend that that statement a little bit, as in the question that we were doing is, definitely a number of samples is a big criteria when we are dealing with machine learning techniques versus deep learning techniques. And I think it gets really tricky or confusing for most of the students when they get started, is like, we have these very small closed regions where we are using SVM classifiers versus MLP classifiers. So it's really hard. Like most of the times they might be giving similar performances, or either SVM could give a better performance, but it's more like it seems like an ad hoc, right? Like you said, like we should start with a simpler word and see if a deep learning based, like a neural net based architecture can work better. But are there any more parameters that you would suggest that people should monitor in order to make their intuition, like which model I should use? Of course, grid search is definitely one of the solutions, but would you have any insights onto which other parameters that they could monitor, or at least make sure that they have a lookout for when they are trying to decide which technique I want to use? Of course, like the brute force technique is always there. I start off from the over here, from very simplistic to the most expensive ones. But would you suggest any other insights that, based on your experience, where people should also look for? Number of annotations or number of samples is definitely one of them. Would you have any insights for other parameters?
Continuing briefly with the number of samples. Yeah, one thing to monitor is learning curves, where you have your training set, your existing training set, and you plot the performance, let's say on the same data set, on the same validation data set, for different sizes of the training set. So let's say you have your training data set, then you take 90% of the data set, the training data set, fit the model, look at the validation set performance. Then you take 80%, look at the validation performance, 70, 60, 50, 40, until you are at 10%, and you see if there's a trend, if you had more data, if it would improve. So that would be one thing I would say looking for. If there's a possibility if you could label more data, then this would be very powerful. It can tell you whether it's even worthwhile or not, and how worthwhile it is. Another thing is really making sure that you don't overfit, which is very challenging. It sounds easy. So we use a validation set, we use cross-validation, but even I noticed in practical applications, it's easy to overfit on K-fold cross-validation even. And for example, I had this case in a real-world data set where I wanted to get really good performance and I was not satisfied. And we had this data set, it had only 100 or so samples, and we had a test set also with hundreds and so samples, relatively small. And I wanted to really get good performance. So I tried gradient boosting, which is usually a good method, but I wanted to really squeeze out more performance. So what I did is I thought, okay, it's not urgent, I have time, so let me run something for 2 weeks. So I set up this crazy, it wasn't 2 weeks, but like a couple of days. So I set up this crazy big randomized search, so in scikit-learn, with the gradient boosting classifier and tuned, I don't know, like it was maybe a million hyperparameter configurations. And then I really got a good one, but on K-fold cross-validation. Then when I applied it to the test set, it was still not very good because it was basically exploiting the splits. It was just coincidentally good on the K-fold cross-validation. I mean, technically it prevents you from overfitting, but the more things you explore, at some point you just get lucky that this particular configuration performs well on the K-fold cross-validation random seed that you are splitting with. So in that case, one thing also might be worthwhile considering. Be mindful of like really how many hyperparameters you tune. Don't go crazy. Or if you do, you really need more. You need like maybe you have to run repeated K-fold cross-validation, for example. And then really you can ask, okay, if I do all this crazy stuff, isn't it worthwhile just to collect more data instead of just doing this? Because you're exploiting really too much. So it's also like maybe there's a way, okay, I don't need to, let's say, go crazy on hyperparameter tuning. Of course, it's important, but 1 million settings is maybe overkill and you end up like exploiting patterns in the way you partition your data. So maybe it's worthwhile thinking about, is there maybe some other approach like working with the data? And one popular area of research or application is this new, I mean, it's called data-centric AI. Some people say it's not new at all. I mean, yeah, it is not really a new idea to manipulate your data set to get better performance, but data-centric AI is a field. I think there is some novelty in that in the sense that you want to spend more time on developing, let's say, methods for exploring the data set and modifying the data set rather than, let's say, the model. So basically keeping the model fixed, but changing the data set to get better model performance. And I think that is something also worthwhile. I have done this a little bit in a non-systematic, sense, but I think this is also something worthwhile in a real-world application where you have especially small data to really spend more time with the data and see what you can do there rather than just with a model.
Yeah. I mean, I can not emphasize more enough, like as in this is something highly relevant to one of the recent work that I'm doing, which we are using the ResNet models, which are like the benchmark of imaging models that we can use right now. And I cannot emphasize when I was talking to my professor and showing my baseline results, as in like I just use my MRI scans as the data input that I have, 3D ResNet model, and we are doing some prediction thing, image-based regression tools over there. And the performances were very bad, and definitely ResNet was not to blame because ResNet has already outperformed on every other data set. And we spent almost, I would say, more than 3 months just to make sure, first of all, how are we creating these folds? How are we organizing, like mapping the age distributions and MRI scans accordingly, making sure that there are not repeated scans of, like there are a few patients, like I have an MRI scan at age 25. I also have an MRI scan at age 30, but that just means we are two same people. So making sure there are not overlapping over there, normalizing the data sets, making sure we are using instance normalization, not batch normalization. And so I can just go on to the details, but I think it just resonates and sounds more what you said is saying data-centric AI is maybe not that much popular back then, but I think it has been very crucial to deep learning, at least to making sure that data goes very correctly inside the model, because what goes around comes out. That's the ideology. So
And related to what you said, it's like also even sometimes useful, I think, having humans look at some data, because I forgot where it was, but I saw this article where people had I think it was MRI or x-rays, and they got really good performance, but it turned out that there was like a watermark in certain types of images. So the model, on paper, if you use any performance metric, it would perform really great, because it does perform great, but there's this little side effect that it was using this watermark, which is non-intentional. And you can't really, with objective metrics, you can't capture that. You really have to, let's say, look at this and understand things. Or what you could do is maybe you can do something like red cam or guided backprop, and you highlight this, but still you need to have someone looking at the results, at failure cases or successful cases, and think about this to make sense. So not everything can be automated. It's maybe one good takeaway.
Exactly. And it comes to the next question that I had for you, but maybe I'll take a detour on the machine learning thing and maybe ask you about a few of the things that about trends, as in, like, you have been in this, like, you have been making the things accessible in terms of blogs, video tutorials, and whatsoever manner, starting from the very basics, like basics from statistical analysis to whole to the deep learning. And nowadays, if you see people who are getting interested into the deep learning tool, they find this very whole resource of things, like they are pretty much confused, like, as in, what do I start with? Because there are lots of techniques, lots of good published articles that can claim good results. And nowadays, like in the very recent, we see like large models, right? Like, we as student or as an individual contributor, you won't be able to run these models. Like it could be GPT-3, large language models. I think the Palm and Dolly that recently came out. What insights do you have, like, as in, what opinions would, like, I wouldn't say opinions, but as in, like, from your understanding of experience and how the field is progressing, do you think large models are gonna be there for a long time, or is it something that, like, we are not improving the architecture per se, but we are just expanding the architecture versus when we have these bigger data sets? So in terms of your own experience, what do you think, like, would large models really solve the issue, or do we have to really think in a very architecture efficient way in order to solve these problems, like, let's say, multimodality and lots of other problems that we have? What has been your experience so far, if you can share?
That is an interesting question. Very tricky. I would say right now, I mean, the recent success of these big models, I would say it justifies looking more into it and doing more research on that. But then at the same point, it's like, where do we stop? Where do we draw the boundary? Because the models become so big that we can't really use them anymore. So how does it help us if we have big models that we can't really use anymore? It goes also a little bit the direction is like, what do we want the model to do, and where do we want to do it? And I don't know. So if you have like a smartphone and you want to have a prediction that should work offline, so it has to be on the phone, so whatever algorithm. So maybe in that case, well, these big models are useless because they are too large for running on a phone. So in that case, well, that's maybe not what I want. But if I am Google and I want the best possible, let's say, query for search, maybe you run this on a big server and this is okay. I mean, so it really depends. I think there's no one size fits all solution. I think every model has its place. One thing I should say though is, these big models, they require a lot of resources to train, but you don't necessarily have to train them always from scratch. This is like the premise behind it, that you can train them on a general purpose data set and then you can fine tune them. And yeah, in my book, in the Transformer chapter, we did that with the BERT model. The BERT model, by the way, it was too big for the GPU memory. So I used Distill BERT, which is like, so distilled version is like a version that is a little bit pruned. It has fewer parameters, but has almost the same performance. And yeah, I was fine tuning that on that IMDb movie dataset. The performance was better than with a recurrent neural network, but I think it took multiple hours to train, and the RNN took 5 minutes to train, which is also one thing to consider, right? So you get maybe 3-4% improvement on that data set, but at what cost? At like 3-4 hours instead of 5 minutes, it's like so much more expensive. And I feel like, yeah, depending on what you want to do, I wouldn't say they solve all our problems, especially when maybe it goes towards like new data sets that are, let's say, very different from the data sets that the models were pre-trained on. There's a chance you can still fine-tune it, it performs well. But yeah, I wouldn't say, I think it's interesting and important to go into this direction. Let's see what happens. But I think other models still have their place. And I think we are just right now a little bit, I would say, stuck with existing methods. So SVMs, random forests have been around forever. Yeah. 20 years, and there are still sometimes a research paper that makes a little improvement, but it's really like, I would say, the low-hanging fruit in that area has been harvested. And the same, I would say, maybe not so much, but the same is somewhat true with CNNs. I think like 5 years ago, we had a new architecture every month that was like groundbreaking. Now, yeah, we still have new architectures, but it's a bit slower, right? So in that case, people are looking for, let's say, something new to explore, and transformers are just right now the thing. At the same point, I think as soon as someone finds a non-transformer model or method that is, let's say, cheaper, I think everyone would be super excited. So I think right now, partly people work on these big transformer models because they are the best we have, but I don't think, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think anyone is happy about the fact that they are so big. I think everyone would wish they would be smaller, and as soon as something comes along that is smaller and, let's say, better performing or even similarly performing, like a new architecture, I think everyone would be super excited and jump to the new architecture. But it's just my thought or my thinking.
Yeah, no, I mean, to me, it makes sense. I mean, it really depends on the application. Like, if you are focusing too much on the very minute details of accuracy, like you said, big firms like who are very heavily invested in like even the minute improvements, they don't care about computation resources. For them, large models in general would be a good fit. But for people who just want a proof of concept or just want to try out a different technique in order to solve the problem, for them, it would be still focusing on like you already mentioned, like if you had the option of using recurrent neural network, if the performance drop is not much of a big issue, then I think they would stick with recurrent neural network rather than going to fine-tune BERTs. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I want to tie back to the one of the other things, like the GradCamp thing that you mentioned, right? Like this was something even I stumbled onto a lot, and I want to learn your perspective on it. Like, do you think interpretability or the whole idea of explainability, like explaining a model's predictions and models working in general, is like a big area of effort for the research community? Like, would you say, like, when we deploy these models, like from a academia perspective, we just care about those tables and metrics, like if I'm beating a state of art, that's like a very important thing. But when we deploy these models in real world scenarios, like the watermark example that you gave, do you think these kind of tools like GradCam or similar, these kind of tools should be an active area of interest of research when we are deploying these models? Or like, I think you would have a better perspective of understanding what these models would look like when they get deployed in the real world. Do you think it's going to be a major area of expertise that would be required when we are actively deploying these models in the real world?
Yeah, I think I'm not an expert, I must say, in interpretable machine learning. By the way, Christoph Molnar, he has a new book on this topic. He, I would say, would be more like a person who can maybe answer this more confidently or more correctly. But I would say, to my knowledge, interpretable machine learning is still a very, not new area, but we are not there where we want to be right now, I think. So right now, I think it's still very hard to explain models. So we have these tools like GradCam or LIME or SHAP values and so forth. But I think, to be honest, just maybe my opinion, but I feel like they are more like diagnostic tools that you use during the development. It's something you use when you want to debug your model. Like we talked about with this watermark, you use maybe GradCam or something else that highlights something. And it's maybe saying, okay, maybe you should look into this. But it's not giving you the explanation. It might not even be correct. Maybe it's highlighting something that doesn't have any meaning. So the fact that it doesn't, I mean, So as a user, if you are giving this model to someone like a doctor for like diagnosing patients, I think this is not super helpful and could maybe even be, I don't know if it could be harmful, maybe it can be, but it's more something we use internally to let's say diagnose problems if they are there. But it is, I don't think these methods are there yet for like deployment. So I don't think they are like capable enough. So what we really want is something more about like predicting what, why the model makes a prediction, right? So that is what most people care about. And I don't think we have methods for that yet. I mean, we have workarounds, but it's not reliable. And I don't think they are there yet. So if I'm a doctor, I want to know like, why, let's say if you have a scan, an X-ray scan or MRI scan, and the prediction is, let's say the person has cancer. Well, no cancer. I think if it just highlights this region, okay, well, it highlights it. So, but what does it mean? What does the highlighted region mean? What does the model see? We don't really know. We maybe know where the model looks at, but we don't really know what the model sees. It could be just a pixel that is flipped, or it could be a certain shape. And I think what we want is more like, I don't know, like some output that says, we see this black spot here in the center, and this is why the model thinks it could be cancer, right? And then as a researcher, I could say, okay, well, as a doctor, I can say, okay, I can look at this black dot, but you know, this is not it, or it is maybe true. Maybe I should zoom in onto that. And I think we don't have this level of diagnostic tools yet. We don't have something that gives such a concrete answer. The only thing that might be useful in practice is like counterfactuals a little bit if you have a tabular data set. See, that also doesn't apply to images. But if you have the problem are maybe that the features themselves are not interpretable. So if you look at an image, it's just made up of pixels, and the model looks at pixels. A convolutional network has like these filters that extract features from the images, from the pixels, but there is no labeling of these features. So they're still just arbitrary, let's say, features. And yeah, I mean, it's not very, let's say, I don't even know how to tackle it. If you have an image, the model makes a prediction based on the abstract features, which are based on some original pixels. So the answer would be more like, okay, pixel 3 is a brightness 0.5, and pixel 5 has this and this and this and this. And altogether, this is because of this threshold that I predict this person has cancer. But these pixels, they don't mean anything to a human in a way, because they're just pixels. So we would have to have some type of meta features almost, like, you know, like two types of models. One model that that extracts meta features, like, I don't know, lung nodule or something like that. And then a method based on that classifying it. And then at least you could interpret these meta features or something. I don't know. But what I wanted to also get at, like counterfactuals, it's like you're analyzing how much do I have to change something in order to get a desired outcome. And I think this can be sometimes useful for certain data sets. If you think about, let's say, like a bank uses a system to predict whether someone should get a loan or a credit card approved or not. And if you have features that are, let's say, intuitive for a human or interpretable, I'm not saying these are good features, but let's say one feature is salary, one feature is, I don't know, like age or something like that. And you do a counterfactual analysis, you can increase and decrease the age and see how it changes the outcome of the prediction, and the same for the salary. And this is something you can then communicate. You can then say to a customer, okay, if you had, let's say, a slightly higher salary, like 5,000 more, then we would have approved it because then the algorithm would be above the threshold. I feel like at that level, yeah, the interpretable methods are somewhat useful, but of course this doesn't apply to images, because then you say, okay, if this pixel was brighter, then we would predict something else. And yeah, it's tricky. I think it's still an active area of research, but yeah, but I'm also not an expert. I was just explaining my thoughts about this, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I this is an interesting thing. Maybe I need to think more about it also. Like, as in you said about the meta features, which is something I really love, because we have the whole target label, but we have millions of features. Like normally when we say like a medical image, which is like a three-dimensional image, which is like more than one million pixels, and we don't have really, like, CNNs create these feature maps in multiple layers and it tries to classify, but we don't really have any labels for them. So you gave a very nice pointer to thinking about it. So yeah, I mean, I'll keep that topic for sure. And one few last questions I want to cover before we end the podcast is your thought process into not a lot of people are aware about like what exactly the research field or academia looks like when they are working with machine learning or deep learning techniques. So what can you share or what advice would you give to people who are considering pursuing research into the machine learning or deep learning academia field? It could be either they are interested into research in industry, but primarily working on research problems, or they could be a PhD student or even just doing their thesis work involving machine learning research. So what are the things like learning from a very implementation, like we got the understanding like, okay, this is these are the basics, this is how k-nearest neighbors or something really work, this is how you implement it, and once these things are done, then comes the research part. So what advice would you give or what insights you would give for people who want to get started into research, that hey, this is something you might be in for when you're signing up for a PhD or like a joining a job that involves machine learning research?
That's a very interesting question. I don't want to be discouraging anyone, but I think it is challenging. Be prepared to see things that don't work. I think when we see papers, it always looks like so easy. In hindsight, it looks like, oh, this is obvious. This is a very easy, even if you think about a dropout, like the technique where you are just dropping notes, it sounds so easy, right? It's like, oh, this is just like an easy method. And sometimes, yeah, you might have this intuitive idea, hey, why don't I just try this and it might work? And then you can find an explanation for that. But then I think most, I would say 90% of the time you have these ideas and they don't work. You try them and they don't work. And I think the key is not getting frustrated by that. Like being like realistic, like, okay, not every idea I'm trying will work. And yeah, this mindset of being prepared that most of the ideas probably won't work. It sounds maybe frustrating, but see, I think there's still always a useful lesson in there, because when you work on things, you get experience. So I would say the time is not wasted because you're still implementing things, you're trying things out. And honestly, I would almost say, I don't think many people do that, but well, if you want to get even more out of it, maybe you can write a blog post. You maybe can't publish a paper, but maybe share that, because other people will maybe want to try something similar. At least you can warn them, hey, this doesn't work. And also, the thing is, I think what's important nowadays is you mentioning like a thing like if you want to go into industry, and I think building a portfolio is important. I think nowadays there are a lot of people getting into machine learning and deep learning, and you want to be a little bit unique. I mean, everyone can take classes, right? So if you take classes, you get good grades. I don't think that is enough anymore today, let's say, because so many people do that. And I think working on cool projects is a good way also to learn. In that case, like you said, if you do research, so back to the point, like trying things out, some things work and don't work. But I think, I mean, of course, people who focus only on theory, but I think based on what I'm interested in also, trying out things, getting like practical experience is very useful, because then you also can apply that to other areas. And also with that, I think it's good early on to apply or to dive not only into deep learning, but also like what is the open source community doing? Like, are there interesting things I can try out, things to improve improve myself productivity wise, like using GitHub and maybe version control with GitHub, unit testing, and maybe setting up a CI, like a continuous integration server on GitHub workflows that tests my code. Like practicing these things, I think, is also very useful, because later on, I noticed that right now, when you go into a company, it's how people work. And you have to also maybe get used to working in a team, because in a PhD, I noticed that, because I was in a very small group, you often work alone, and it can be sometimes good to like work with others together, and the open source community is usually very welcoming. So contributing maybe to an open source project, of course, you don't want to make this like 90% of your day. You want to be careful with your time, that most of the time is aligned with, let's say, your research. But I think it's also the time where you learn other things. And I think being open, being explorative, being open to exploration and collaborations, I think it's one thing I would also say maybe you should look out for during the PhD.
Yeah. I love that. And one thing I wanna extend is, like you said, like there are lots of people coming into machine learning, which makes sense. I mean, even from a research perspective, like I joined my research in 2020, right? So, and when I was like, I think this is still, we are in the phase of people publishing a lot of papers, a lot of good papers that are coming out every week, I think. Mm-hmm. Like if you follow, like I follow a lot of academics on Twitter, and like it feels like me posting on Instagram is like equivalent to they posting papers on Twitter. So it's very hard to keep up with such amount of work, and they're excellent works. So it's not something that they're publishing anything random. So how do you personally make sure that you are reading the best of the kind of papers or at least ideas? Because as a student, maybe I'm a very naive person, so maybe I don't have that filter set. Like, okay, this is what I want to read. This is what I maybe not relevant to my active area of research. So how do you basically, like my question would be, how do you cope up with such amount of pump of papers every now and then?
That is a very tricky and important question, because you want to make sure that you balance your fear of missing out and burning out. You don't want to like go crazy like in terms of reading everything, because then you don't have time for anything else. And at the same time, you want to maybe read a little bit so you are up to date with things. So like as a personal anecdote, I was like for the machine learning category on Archive, one of the moderators a few years ago for like a couple of years. And so what we do there is, so in Archive, you submit a paper, and then nowadays you can classify which category it belongs to. But sometimes people get it wrong. So we have a classifier, NLP classifier, that predicts the correct categories, but it's not always very confident, and also it makes mistakes sometimes. So the task of the moderators was just to scan through the titles of every submission and make sure, okay, this is... if it has, let's say, computer vision CNNs in the title, it's probably a computer vision paper. But sometimes it's more vague, and maybe sometimes it's not clear. Maybe the prediction is wrong. You click on the paper, you browse through it, and then maybe assign the correct label. But yeah, at the end of the day, you were like looking through all the submissions each day. And when I started, there were like 100 maybe papers a day. In the end, last year or something, there were like almost sometimes 200 or 300 papers a day. If there's a conference, maybe sometimes even more. And you can't read it all. It's like, imagine 200 new machine learning papers every day. And you can maybe read one. I honestly have a hard time even reading one per day, because I want to balance my time. I have my job, I have work. I have maybe other things like research. In the evening, I want to learn something. So usually I work on my regular job, but then in the evening, if time permits, I do some of my research. I do some learning, like either I read a book and stuff. So there's only so much time you have, right? So reading a paper takes me, it depends if I want to read it really thoroughly for a review, many hours. But let's say if I skim through it, it's half an hour to an hour to get like everything in a way that makes sense. You don't read it like super carefully, but you read it reasonably carefully. Yeah. So half an hour. And this can be a lot. I mean, if you have other things to do. So you want to be careful picking, like you said, papers that are worthwhile reading. So what I do is actually, when I find interesting titles, I have like a notebook, basically, where I keep all, I have categories. I have a category like activation function, let's say gradient boosting, I don't know, like interpretable machine learning, model evaluation. I have these different categories. And if I find something interesting, a blog post or an article, I usually put them there. And I just put them there so I know, okay, I can come back to it later, but I don't start reading right away, because then you get really, it's infinite. You have to be really, really careful with your time, basically. And then what I do is I do a weekly review every week. Usually I do the Sunday night. And there I go through my lists, and I have for the week a task, read 2 papers. Not more. I mean, sometimes it depends, but this is my minimum goal. Sometimes I read more. There are actually weeks where I don't even read 2 papers, but I go through my list and which are the most worthwhile papers I should read. And then I pick it like based on time. So what I'm trying to say is, maybe I would say see how much time you have. Maybe you have time for one paper a day, but don't basically approach it from how much time you have and then fit the papers in rather than how many papers there are and then trying to make time to just read all the papers. Because, I mean, it's a trade-off. In an ideal world, I wish I could read all the papers, but you have to make trade-offs, right? So it's like paper reading is important, especially if you are working on a paper. There are sometimes weeks where I read, let's say, 10 papers a day because I have to write the related work section or something. But most of the time, I think, I would try to read papers as much as you can. But yeah, you want to also create. I think creating knowledge is almost as important. I mean, you need to learn in order to create, but I almost try to spend as much time creating as I can and then also absorbing knowledge. But see, also the methods or techniques that are really worthwhile, they will make it into a textbook one day. So you don't, there's a lot of, you think the papers are important that you're reading, but I think maybe only 5 out of 100 papers that you're reading really have a long-lasting impact too. So in that case, yeah, it is worthwhile reading papers, but I would say it's almost a better bang for the buck if you read textbooks. So because someone curated the list of papers for you. Of course, it's always a few years behind, but it is a trade-off, right? I mean, balancing your time. There's no right or wrong, really, but I'm just thinking, you can spend too much time on papers. I would be selective, not spending the whole day on it, basically. But it's tricky because there's so much cool stuff out there. So
definitely I love that. I think these are the set of questions I had. I think we are fairly I'm fairly hogging your time over here, but these are the set of questions I have, mostly for people who are listening to this podcast. I'll be leaving your lot of handles. I think you have a very interesting blog on your website, so I'll be leaving that link over here, your Twitter, where I think I personally have enjoyed your tweets. Like, I think you have a very nice summaries, like at least for the at least in the last few months I have seen, like you have this very two-line thing that you share your opinions about, and it helps at least for people like us to filter out, okay, if this person is saying maybe I should at least check out what this paper or at least what this article is about. So I'll leave your Twitter over here, so for people who want to get interested. But apart from that, thanks a lot. I think this conversation was great. I really had some very nice insights, at least getting started. And people, like most of the people who are listening to this podcast, are getting started into the research world. They're exploring and they're primarily interested what lies ahead for them in the field. So I think you as a person and also your resources with your books, it would be a perfect fit. So thanks a lot for being on the podcast, and thanks for writing the books. I think for us, it's really critical to have these kind of resources.
Cool. Thanks so much for the invitation. I think we had a great time chatting about things. I liked really your questions. It was really like these questions that made me think, but then I think hopefully gave useful answers. I don't know. You will, or the community will tell me. But it was fun. I like chatting about these things. And that's the thing also when I'm teaching. I always tend to go on tangents, so I don't mind. Ask me anything. I will happily chat about it, whether it's useful or not. I don't know, but if you tell me it was good, so I hope it was at least fun. Let's say it like that. So I had a good time, and maybe we can do this again in the future. Because you probably have more questions than you already asked. Yeah. But
definitely. I did miss out on a few of the questions, definitely, just to keep a track of time. But I'll definitely love to have you once more. So but thanks a lot for being here.
All right, cool. Then have a great rest of the day, and have fun learning, and good luck with your research too.